From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. It's hot, dusty, and dangerous all around you. Your convoy is rolling through the streets, and the smell of sweat and burning trash fill your nostrils. It could be Baghdad, but it's not. It's a virtual reality simulator at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. The Army has created a high-tech virtual Iraq that looks, smells, and feels like a war zone. The goal is to get the soldiers to cope with their trauma and move beyond it. The virtual Iraq simulator is just one example of how doctors and therapists are using new technology to help people overcome trauma and phobias. Virtual reality simulators are now used for everything from a fear of public speaking to alcohol addiction. Later in the hour, we'll hear about some of those programs, but first, a look at Walter Reed's virtual Iraq. Joining us in the studio is Dr. Michael Roy. He's a colonel in the Medical Corps of the U.S. Army, director of the Division of Military Internal Medicine, and professor of medicine in the Uniformed Services University of the Health Services. Michael Roy, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
It's also with us in the studio is David Cohn, health and science reporter with the Baltimore Sun. David Cohn, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
Dr. Roy, allow me to begin with you. The virtual Iraq simulation includes the sights, sounds, and smells of Iraq. Tell us a little bit more about what this simulation experience is like and how you actually lead a patient through a session.
Sure. Well, it's four senses that we're stimulating with this program: sight, sound, smell, and the sense of touch. And so we start off very gradually with the program. In fact, for the first three therapy sessions, we don't use the virtual environment at all. We just prepare them for it and use some cognitive behavioral techniques to try to teach them how to relax a little better, deep breathing techniques and so forth. And we prepare them for what they'll be facing in a variety of different ways, educating them about the program. Then we introduce the virtual reality in the fourth session, and then it comprises up to about half of the session, or 45 out of the 90 minutes in the virtual environment. In the first three sessions, learn their story, and so that helps to guide where we insert them in the program. So if, for example, somebody had a traumatic experience involving an IED hitting their vehicle, destroying their vehicle while they're in a convoy going through the desert, we won't start off with that sort of an experience. We'll start off perhaps having them walk through an urban environment, a marketplace, in and out of buildings and so forth. And then eventually, when we feel that they're ready, in monitoring their subjective reports as well as their blood pressure, heart rate, respiratory rate, how much they're sweating, then when we feel they're ready, we'll progress to something more closely approximating their individual traumatic experience. And we might start off with just the sound or just the visual, and then we'll add in the other senses. So it's a very gradual exposure, and we find that generally that helps to trigger memories on their part that they might have difficulty coming up with alone, and that allows the therapist to then work through these both the initial trauma and the subsequent feelings and reactions they've had to it.
David Cohn, from what I read in your piece, you put on a pair of virtual reality goggles and earphones, and what happens then?
I did. It's very intense. I should start by saying I've never been to Iraq. I've never been in combat, so I can't speak to how well it holds up to that experience, but it's a very intense experience. You're really kind of immersed in this world. You have earphones on. One of the things that was very powerful for me is they have a gun, an actual M16 that you're given to hold, because it makes it feel more real, and you're there, and all of a sudden you're besieged by insurgents firing rockets at you, the sound of gunfire. In one of the setups, you're driving a Humvee through the desert, and as you're being fired upon, the person in the passenger seat gets injured. So if you look over at them, you're wearing a set of VR goggles. You turn your head and you see your buddy in the seat next to you, and he's bleeding from a very serious wound. And the whole thing is it becomes overwhelming after a little while. You start to just feel under pressure. There's another setup where you're on a foot patrol through a city that's sort of like Fallujah, and the same kinds of things are happening to you. You're besieged. You hear the sound of babies crying, civilians, the sound of Arabic being spoken. People are popping up and firing at you. It's just a very, very intense experience.
Which is why, as Dr. Roy explains, you want to have somebody have a few sessions before they go into that experience. Our producer, Tara Boyle, went to Walter Reed on Friday to take part in the virtual Iraq simulation, although she wasn't quite sure what to expect when she arrived.
The room where the simulations take place isn't much to look at. It's tiny, just enough space for a desk, two computers, and a basic black office chair sitting on a platform. This is where clinical psychologist Jennifer Francis works with soldiers suffering from trauma and PTSD. She guides me through what the soldiers experience.
Well, the first session, we spend a bit of time kind of educating the patient about what the treatment program involves and the purpose of it. So initially, describing to them that this treatment is 12 sessions for approximately 6 weeks, 90-minute sessions. And during this time, we'll be focusing on two primary PTSD symptoms, avoidance and kind of maladaptive beliefs.
Francis hands me a computer joystick, helps me put on the virtual reality goggles and some headphones, and then opens small jars containing pellets that smell like burning garbage and cordite. The simulation begins. A street in an Iraqi city is projected on the inside of the goggles. It reminds me of a video game. I walk past vendors selling fruits and vegetables, and then a child standing in the street. I hear the call to prayer from a local mosque, and a couple of guys start shouting angrily in my direction. And then, suddenly, this. When the simulation ends, I can feel my heart beating faster than normal. Make no mistake, the simulation is intense. Even a little scary. But most patients at Walter Reed don't start out with an experience that extreme. The goal is to get them to slowly face their memories and then move past them. Jennifer Francis says the program is designed for soldiers who might otherwise resist describing what they experienced in Iraq.
We have them repeatedly confront memories and the people, places, and things that they may be avoiding. And through imaginal exposure is how we confront the memories. And that's done in a very systematic way, repeatedly, with the goal of having the individual habituate to the anxiety that they experience from the traumatic memories.
Researchers at Walter Reed will study 88 soldiers to determine the effectiveness of virtual Iraq. Jennifer Francis says although it's too early to draw any conclusions about the PTSD study, she and the other researchers are encouraged by what they're observing.
I think just anecdotally in terms of the actual response to the environment has been very strong in terms of people's ability to engage in it and actually experience expected anxiety from the environment. So it's not just a video game for people that have been through combat.
Tara Boyle, WAMU 88.5 News.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on virtual reality and mental health treatment with David Cohn, health and science reporter with the Baltimore Sun, and Dr. Michael Roy, director of the Division of Military Internal Medicine and professor of medicine in the Uniformed Services University of the Health Services. Dr. Roy is also a colonel in the Medical Corps of the U.S. Army. Dr. Roy, it's my understanding that the virtual Iraq program is based on a concept known as exposure therapy. What exactly does that mean?
That is correct. Exposure therapy is really the best evidenced treatment that we have for PTSD today. The most commonly used method is what's called imaginal exposure, which asks the individual to close their eyes, picture that they're back where the traumatic experience occurs, and to describe in as vivid detail as they can what they saw, what they heard, what they felt, what they smelled. And one of the cardinal features of PTSD is avoidance of any reminders of the trauma. So for those soldiers who are actually able to engage in imaginal exposure, it works quite well. The problem is that for many individuals, they try as they might, it's very difficult to do that when you want to just avoid anything that reminds you of the trauma, and it causes a variety of physiologic responses, sweating, speeding up of the heart rate, and so forth. It's often really difficult to put themselves in that. So that's the whole idea behind the virtual reality, is to facilitate that recall of the memory and the feelings, the reactions that they had in response to it, and how it's, and get them to describe how it's continuing to trouble them today, how it's continuing to interfere with their lives.
So I guess it's a lot more difficult for those individuals than it was for David Cohn or for Tara Boyle, who had never themselves been in that situation before, but nevertheless reported fairly intense feelings and a sped up heart rate as a result of it.
That's correct. I mean, again, that's why we go very gradually, and we use the physiologic monitoring as well as asking them every 5 minutes, how distressed do you feel? We want to push the envelope some. We want them to experience some discomfort, some anxiety, and we believe that that's really part of why it's therapeutic. We have to get them to that point, but we don't want to push them too far. So that's why we use both the physiologic monitoring and their subjective report of how they're doing throughout the session.
Allow me to bring our listening audience in on the conversation. Do you think that virtual reality environments can really help people dealing with mental health conditions, or do you think this is just the latest high-tech fad? You can call us at 800-433-8850, 800-433-8850, or send email to Kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. It's a Tech Tuesday conversation. David Cohn, the Iraq that one sees in this simulation is more like a video game for some than an actual lived experience, except for those who have actually lived the experience. But it's my understanding that researchers regularly incorporate ideas from soldiers to make the simulations more realistic.
Yeah, that was one of the really interesting things. Talking to the people who were really sort of driving this, there's a psychologist in California, Skip Rizzo, who's sort of the generator of a lot of this. And Dr. Roy is also doing this. They're constantly soliciting ideas from the soldiers to make it more realistic. The gun idea, I mentioned that they use a gun in this. It's not a toy gun. It's not a real M16, but it's not a toy, a plastic drugstore toy. It's a full weighted toy. And right when they were beginning this, a soldier said, this doesn't feel right. I'm sitting in a chair while I'm going on patrol. When I'm on a real patrol, I'm not in a chair. I'm holding a gun. And so they found a way to... they mounted the little video game control on top of the gun. So a lot of times what the soldiers do, the patients do, is they'll be standing up while they go through the game, because that's how you go on patrol. You don't go on patrol rolling around in a, desk chair. They're now incorporating a friendly fire part of the game, because that's one of the things that can intensely elicit post-traumatic stress disorder, is friendly fire incidents. They're working on an Afghanistan module so that soldiers who are getting PTSD while in Afghanistan, it's a little bit of a different look. I mean, the way Afghanistan looks is, I've never been to either place, but it looks a little bit different than Iraq, a little more mountainous, I understand. Even little things, there was a switch, an on-off switch in the Humvee part of it. And one of the first soldiers who ever did this said, I can't drive this Humvee because the thing is in the off position. This vehicle won't run. So they went back, the coders went back and tweaked it in the program to make it so that it was in the on position.
Dr. Roy, how realistic does a simulation have to be for a person who has very specific memories of a painful or traumatic experience?
That's a really good question, and something that I don't know that we really can answer fully at this time, but a lot of researchers believe that the auditory element seems to be particularly important. For example, the virtual reality treatment of PTSD for survivors of 9/11 at the World Trade Center, the auditory track is actually from NBC News, I believe, and so it's certainly quite realistic. The video, the visual element, probably is not quite as important, at least that's the thinking. The sense of smell may be particularly important. The olfactory bulb is very close proximity to the areas of the brain that seem to be particularly important for PTSD, the limbic system, the hypothalamus, the amygdala.
I would suspect the sense of smell is very important, because I have noticed that how I distinguish between countries and places that I have visited is that the second time I go to those places, the first thing I tend to recognize is the smell of the place. So that's particularly important.
Right, we believe so. Actually, we'd like to eventually do a study, a kind of a dissimulating study, where we look at functional MRI, we look at how various senses stimulate the brain, looking at each one independently, but that hasn't been done yet.
You mentioned the name Rizzo. That was the researcher who got the Virtual Iraq program off the ground. He's out in California, Albert Rizzo. How did he get interested in these virtual treatments?
He's a really interesting guy. He about 15 years ago, he was a regular psychologist working with people who had brain trauma. And he noticed that, and one of the problems with brain trauma is people have trouble focusing. So what you're trying to do in the treatment is help them learn to focus on things. And these people were having trouble with that. And he noticed during a break from the therapy that some of his patients were playing with these little Game Boy machines that were popular in the 90s and were just completely focused on them. They weren't having any trouble focusing. And he had a kind of an epiphany, a moment of vision. And he realized that virtual reality and computers might be a way to help a lot of people who are having these sorts of problems. So he quit his job. He was making $80,000 a year. He quit his job, and he took a kind of a fellowship at University of Southern California, making $30,000 a year, a big pay cut there. But he was working with computers. He just had this vision that this could be a really useful thing. And over the past 15 years, he's built up this program. He's done all these sorts of virtual reality things. And he's an interesting guy. He's not a sort of button-down military guy. He works a lot with the military, but he has a long ponytail. He drives a motorcycle. I think it's a Harley. He plays blues harmonica.
He took a big pay cut.
$50,000. I think I don't know what he's at now, but I imagine he's back up. He's doing a little bit better now. He's the director of a program at USC in this. But what he did when the Iraq War started in 2003 and it became apparent that the war wasn't going to end quickly, he realized that there was a real potential that a lot of the soldiers coming back might be suffering from PTSD. So we started working on a program that would help these soldiers, help treat these soldiers. And so over the past 5 years, he's been working on this and progressively improving it. And the result of this is Virtual Iraq.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this Tech Tuesday discussion on virtual reality and mental health treatment. We'll be joined by Josh Spitalnik, who's Director of Research and Clinical Services at Virtually Better, and we'll tell you what Virtually Better is when we come back. I'm Kojo Nandi. Join me, Kojo Namdi, this Friday afternoon at 1:15 for an online chat. We'll spend some time together discussing the issues and news that's on your mind. Go to conversation.wamu.org and become part of our growing community of public radio fans. I'll meet you online this Friday, beginning right after the Politics Hour at 1:15.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More from NPR News.
Next time on Tell Me More, a new documentary explores one woman's journey after she discovered a part of her family tree is rotten.
What no one in my family realized was that the DeWolfs were the largest slave trading family in U.S. history.
Join us as we take a look at Traces of the Trade, Stories from the Deep North, next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock today here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the University of Maryland Baltimore County's Department of Information Systems, UMBC offers an online master's program in information systems. Applications for the fall semester are due August 10th. Information at 800-353. UMBC.
Welcome back. It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking virtual reality and mental health treatment with Dr. Michael Roy, Colonel in the Medical Corps of the U.S. Army and Director of the Division of Military Internal Medicine and Professor of Medicine in the Uniformed Services University of the Health Services. David Cohn joins us in the studio also. He is health and science reporter with the Baltimore Sun. Allow me to go to Kara in Washington, D.C. Kara, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm driving right now, and I'm really enjoying the show, and I thought of a question because I'm a smoker, and I know a lot of smokers, and you mentioned at the beginning of the show that this might eventually trickle down into other types of psychology and treatment, and, you know, for things like helping people to stop smoking and things like that. And it's pretty well known that most technology begins in the military and then trickles down. And I'm wondering about the cost of this type of treatment and whether you actually think there's a real chance of it becoming something that people can use in just, you know, their everyday lives and regular treatment.
Dr. Roy?
Sure. First, I guess I should say that the opinions that I express here are really my own. They're not necessarily those of the Department of the Army or Department of Defense. But you make an excellent point. And in fact, we're with some of my colleagues at Uniformed Services University, we're working on a proposal to try to treat tobacco addiction with virtual reality and, you know, by itself as well as with some of the medications that are available. There are some virtual environments out there now that treat alcoholism, drug abuse, where you may go to a party, for example, and an individual is offering you something, and, you know, so you have to address that, deal with that in the virtual environment, and we think it would be relatively easy to adapt this to smoking cessation as well.
And from what I understand, David Cohn, by today's standards, the equipment doesn't cost that much and could soon pay for itself.
Yeah, it's not so expensive. I mean, the basic cost of the equipment to do this with the virtual Iraq is about $7,000 for a setup. And that sounds like a lot. It is a lot. But if you think of the relative cost in terms of society and in terms of each person of not treating this, of having someone who has untreated PTSD continuing to live for years or decades, it's relatively inexpensive. One thing I wanted to add about to the caller's question, I mean, this, as I understand it, you can adapt this a virtual reality treatment to all kinds of things. The basic idea is you want to virtually expose someone to some situation that's causing them a problem. There's a researcher in Atlanta who's using this successfully to treat a fear of heights. You know, you set someone up where they're in it looks like a very high place, and you teach them, look, you're in a high place, you feel like you're going to die, but over the course of several treatments, you learn, your body learns, this is not true, I'm not going to die by being in this high place. So there are all sorts of potential therapies that can be used with this.
Kara, thank you very much for your call. Joining us now is Josh Spitalnik, Director of Research and Clinical Services at Virtually Better. That's a Georgia-based company that creates virtual reality simulations programs. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your company developed the virtual Iraq program, but before that, you designed a virtual Vietnam more than a decade ago to help veterans from that war. What have you learned since then about the best ways to use this technology with people suffering from PTSD?
I would say the best things we've learned, and this is not just with PTSD, but sort of addressing Kara's question a second ago, is the application of virtual reality technology to treat a variety of mental health and other medical conditions is widespread. It's quite effective, and it's quite easy to demonstrate in science. I think what we've learned since Vietnam, more than anything, is that there are a large number of individuals, military and otherwise, who are not getting their needs met in a certain way, and the military and the Department of Defense and other institutes are providing a lot of support, a lot of training, and a lot of money to get the servicemen and women's needs met as soon as possible. So virtual reality is just one venue in which we're providing another level of care to people who need it.
You've created virtual airplanes, virtual audiences for people who have a fear of public speaking and the like. You've got programs for people dealing with painful memories of 9/11 or Hurricane Katrina, correct?
Yes, we have environments that really address as many different things that you can imagine. You think of alcohol, cannabis or marijuana addiction, crack cocaine addiction, nicotine addiction, fear of flying, fear of heights, fear of storms, fear of interviews, and probably the most common fear in the United States is fear of public speaking. And our company is probably the first company to pioneer and develop this. We hold several patents to develop virtual reality technology for mental health applications, and we've weathered the storm over the last 15 years or so of the ebb and flow of technology and have really become a mainstay in the industry. And just to share with Kara and others out there, there are quite affordable and quite accessible treatments out there across the country that our company has been a large part of. We have many clinical and research partners across the U.S., and any individual in most regions of the country can find a practitioner who does use virtual reality technology to treat a variety of the issues I've raised.
One of the things I don't understand is that you've completed initial testing on a module for people dealing with chronic pain. Chronic pain, as far as I know, is not a mental health issue. It's a physical issue. How do you have a module for people dealing with that?
I think that's a really great point. The real genius behind virtual reality is it only goes as far as our minds can limit it. And I think with chronic pain and other issues, I'd include substance abuse as well, there truly is a medical organic component to many of the issues that I think will be discussed today. But with that, there are psychological and behavioral components. And as Dr. Roy pointed out early on in this program, virtual reality and most of the technologies is really just an adaptation, an extension of a form of treatment called cognitive behavioral therapy. And cognitive behavioral therapy in and of itself has been used to treat issues of chronic pain, has been used with cancer populations and surgical populations, kids going to the dentist. This form of talk therapy has been used for many years. And what tech people have done is have found a new medium to bring cognitive behavioral interventions up front and more accessible and more cost affordable and in a more systematic, safe, and controlled manner. So with chronic pain specifically, what we're really doing is adapting the concepts of cognitive behavioral therapy, which include distraction and keeping people engaged in working memory activities to pretty much distract them from the pain. And we find this has been used with burn survivors, with gunshot wound victims, with, again, kids going to the dentist, with cancer patients, that if you can distract them and engage them in some innovative, creative activity, as Dr. Rizzo found out early on with his patients, you're really distracting them and keeping them engaged in a level that they're not focused on the pain. And there's a reduction of pain medications and a reduction of stay of hospitalization. It's quite fascinating.
800-433-8850 is the number to call if you'd like to participate in this discussion on virtual reality and mental health treatments. If you're someone who's got a phobia, maybe a fear of spiders or a fear of flying, do you think a virtual reality simulation would help you? Call us, 800-433-8850, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Let's go to David in Silver Spring, Maryland. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Kojo, this may seem like a silly question, except for those of us who get uncomfortable in IMAX theaters, I suppose. But if I were participating in a virtual reality that were moving in a car or walking along while I personally was stationary, that would make me ill, I believe. And I wonder, you know, physically sick. And I wonder if they encounter that problem and what they can do to mitigate that, or could this procedure be used to treat that problem?
Well, Dr. Roy, what do you do to prevent David from throwing up, or after David has thrown up?
Well, it's a good question. There is a phenomenon known as cyber sickness, but it's quite rare. We haven't really had that problem in our treatment program thus far. Again, it's a gradual approach. In our environment, the patient does control the pace and the direction, whether they're walking or whether they're driving the Humvee. They're in charge of the pace and where they go and so forth. Sometimes we need to give them some guidance, asking that they slow down. Sometimes it's misinterpreted as sort of a video game, and we don't want them just racing through the environment.
David, thank you very much for your call. I don't know, Josh, did David just give you an idea for another module?
Lots of ideas for more modules. But just to sort of piggyback on what Dr. Roy said, I think it is a relevant issue. And all of the work that we've done at Virtually Better, which is why I think the company has been so successful and thrived over the years, is we are a very research-oriented institution that does develop clinical interventions, then commercializes them. And in doing so, we conduct assessments on cyber sickness or simulation sickness, both pre, during, and post-assessment, to make sure that the individuals that we're treating were not exacerbating any difficulties. And there have been some reports, largely in older populations or individuals who already have motion sickness prior to exposure to virtual reality. But it's something that most people who are researching VR are constantly aware of and constantly assessing to make sure that we're not doing more harm than good.
David Cohen, skeptics say there isn't enough research to show that this therapy actually works. What evidence do we have of its effectiveness thus far?
It's a fair point. There's not a lot of research on this. I mean, it looks good. It's a kind of very sexy technology. when you talk to the people about it, it's good. But there isn't a lot of research. The most, sort of lockdown study so far has been one of some a group of first responders from 9/11 who were having a lot of trouble with PTSD and had tried a whole lot of treatments. They'd gone through the typical treatments, the kind of exposure therapy without any kind of virtual aspect, and hadn't had any success. They'd gone through all kinds of drugs, hadn't had any success. And it was a small study, but they got very good results. So these are people, these are the toughest people to treat. These are the people that have failed with all the other treatments. And when they tried the virtual treatment, almost all of them got completely better. So it's there's some evidence.
Dr. Roy, anecdotal evidence based on your observations?
Well, certainly there's actually quite good evidence for a range of phobias, a fear of flying, fear of heights, social phobia, that virtual reality probably works better than standard imaginal exposure therapy. For PTSD treatment, that's really why we're doing our study and comparing it directly to imaginal exposure. So hopefully with the results of our study, we'll find that it works at least as well, if not better. I think that really, the idea behind it is that it'll be more appealing to many soldiers in our environment, and that it will accelerate the response to therapy. But yes, thus far, the studies for PTSD have been largely uncontrolled or compared to weightless controls. We're the first to really compare it to the standard of care.
One thing, if I could add, just on
sure.
that, it's this has a potential to be much more appealing. In two ways. One, it's a generational thing. You know, these are, especially if you have returning soldiers, these are mostly young guys. And there's a kind of video game component to this that may potentially attract them. So it's not only that it works, but you can get them into the therapy and you can get them motivated to do the therapy. And there's also, you know, even in this day and age, 2008, among a lot of people, and particularly among young macho males, there's a kind of a sense that, you know, you don't want to go to therapy. Therapy is something that weak people do, and you're a tough soldier. But if you're going to virtual reality training, something like that, if you can pitch it in that way, maybe some of these soldiers will be more likely to actually take part in the therapy.
Josh Spitalnik, I've heard that people are now considering whether this may be useful for children with autism or elderly people with Alzheimer's disease. What do you know about that?
Yeah, the virtual reality technology, again, as I think others have stated, really has wide applications. But beyond virtual reality, which when we're using that technology or that terminology, really what we're describing is, as Dr. Roy has described, it's you're in this system, you have this head-mounted display or these goggles on, you have headphones on, you're on a platform that's vibrating. It's a very immersive experience. But there's other technologies out there. Some of the more networking, social networking applications like Second Life and other ones like those are really trying to tap into and get beyond the boundaries of going to see a therapist or a shrink and bringing it to the masses. So I know Second Life, there are individuals, non-clinicians, non-doctors, but who are autistic themselves or who know someone who's autistic, have developed these wonderful virtual environments where people can come and socially network. And autism is one of those unique ones where the social difficulties are quite prominent. So having a way to sort of meet people virtually, of course, is a real nice advantage. But also with Alzheimer's populations, really the technology is widespread. It's being used with physical rehabilitation, motor rehabilitation, and specifically with the military, traumatic brain injuries are becoming a real concern for the healthcare providers in the military. And so virtual reality technology is even going to that level to find ways to treat issues with regard to balance issues, memory issues for anyone who's had any sort of closed or open-headed traumatic brain injury in wartime.
We're going to take another short break. If you've already called, stay on the line. We'll try our best to get to your call, or you can send us an email to kojo@wamu.org. It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking virtual reality and mental health treatment. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, how times change. Once a haven for those avoiding military service, today Canada is deporting some American soldiers who are fleeing the Iraq War. We look at the debate up north. Plus, we're sporting views with George Solomon. Find out why fans of Dancing with the Stars may soon be fans of the Washington Redskins. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5. Join me, Kojo Namdi, this Friday afternoon at 1:15 for an online chat. We'll spend some time together discussing the issues and news that's on your mind. Go to conversation.wamu.org and become part of our growing community of public radio fans. I'll meet you online this Friday, beginning right after the Politics Hour at 1:15.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock today on Tell Me More, it's from NPR News.
Next time on Tell Me More, a new documentary explores one woman's journey after she discovered a part of her family tree is rotten.
What no one in my family realized was that the DeWolfs were the largest slave trading family in U.S. history.
Join us as we take a look at traces of the trade, stories from the deep north, next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5. We are now at 12:42. We return to the Kojo Namdi Show.
Welcome back to our Tech Tuesday conversation on virtual reality and mental health treatment with Dr. Michael Roy, Colonel in the Medical Corps of the U.S. Army and Director of the Division of Military Internal Medicine and Professor of Medicine in the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. David Cohn is Health and Science Reporter with the Baltimore Sun. Josh Spitalnik joins us from studios in Atlanta, Georgia. He's Director of Research and Clinical Services at Virtually Better, which is a Georgia-based company that creates virtual reality simulation programs. He's also a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory University School of Medicine. And joining us now by telephone from Houston is Patrick Bordnick, who is a professor in the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. His research looks at how virtual reality therapies can be used for people with drug and alcohol addictions. Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Hey, how are you guys doing this morning?
We're doing well. 8 years ago, you were a traditional researcher studying the cues that make people crave drugs and alcohol. How did you develop an interest in virtual reality?
Well, much like Skip, I was sitting in my office one day trying to figure out how we can improve research. What we would do in years ago and traditional methods, we would bring people into the clinic or a lab setting and expose them to situations or role plays, let's say an offer to use drugs or to drink, or we'd bring them in and actually show them the real objects, and we'd monitor their behavior and reactions in hopes to develop ways to help them learn to overcome cravings or to teach them skills to overcome these issues. The problem I had was it just seemed fake. They were sitting across from Dr. Bordnick or another trained therapist, and you're trying to act as if you are a friend of theirs, trying to offer them a drink so you can role play a therapeutic skill. It just was the wrong context, and I couldn't get past that. So I said, there's got to be a better way to put someone in a real bar or a real using situation so they can experience all of the emotions and feelings and everything that goes with that, and to be able to work with them in that setting, because when they leave my office, they're going to be going to those settings. So how can we teach them a skill that would transfer from our clinical setting to the real world, and virtual reality started to fill that void?
Either that or turn your office into a crack house, which is not what you were prepared to do at that point. You're currently doing a clinical study that exposes people to virtual environments where they'll be tempted to smoke. Can you tell us more about that study and what you're trying to accomplish with it?
Yes, basically what we've developed, obviously if you work with smokers, if you think, we actually calculated this out about a month ago, looking at the amount of times someone smokes. If you're smoking a pack a day, how many times that cigarette or lighting up is paired with things in your environment. Going back to conditioning or sort of Pavlov and his dog, which everybody remembers, smoking becomes paired with a lot of things in people's lives, whether it be sex is common, driving in a car, eating, drinking, having anxiety, or being, you know, at work, you get in an argument with somebody, you want to have a cigarette. Well, what we designed and developed, working with Virtually Better closely, is a series of environments that we put people in. And I want to stress that this is, virtual reality is a tool. It's not treating the people. You need a trained therapist to do this. But our therapists have a series of scenarios. One of them is an airport. And we have the smoke aquarium is what we've called, but basically the smoking lounge. And the therapist can put that smoker in there that's trying to quit and they can walk around the airport, walk past the smoking lounge, smell the smoke, hear the people smoking, see them, see cigarettes, and the therapist can now teach them skills while they're in the virtual environment to overcome craving or ways to avoid that particular situation to help them deal more effectively with the situation that we believe in our research will then transfer to when that patient is out there and encounters a friend smoking or is in a bar or an airport or goes to their car and they see their car and it's a trigger to smoke. Maybe they can practice some of the skills that they learned in the virtual car that will allow them to not smoke.
The Virtual Iraq program that we've been talking about this hour seems designed to trigger specific memories and emotions in soldiers. I've got two questions along that line. The first is for you, Patrick. Your research focuses on cravings, which are obviously also tied up in memories and emotions. Do you know what's happening in the brain of a patient in one of your studies on addiction?
Interesting you asked that question. In 2 weeks from now, we are going to do some fMRI research looking at people being exposed to virtual reality drug cues or smoking cues, and we're going to look in a comparison of what's actually going on within the individual's brain when they're confronted with these more realistic or naturalistic stimuli presented in a virtual environment.
You know, and this might be for you, Josh Spitalnik, or you, Dr. Michael Roy, this email from Louise. I'm wondering if exposure therapy would help people who have not personally lived the trauma. For example, I know some African Americans who experience ancestral traumatic memory episodes, even though this specific individual may not have personally lived the trauma. First, you, Josh Spitalnik.
I would say anytime you're doing exposure therapy of any kind, the goal is to bring someone back to a place of fear. That fear can be a real experience. That fear can be a memory. But I think one of the novelties of virtual reality is to create an environment that often is either too logistically, financially, or safety-wise too difficult to treat in vivo or for real. So putting someone really in a car or really on an airplane. So I think the email that was sent in is a good one to be addressed in a therapeutic environment. I don't believe that virtual reality would be required to address such a situation, though as many of the speakers on today's program have discussed, the kind of treatment called imaginal exposure, which does help you to relive and discuss and re-experience many of the thoughts and memories you're having associated with any kind of trauma, one you've personally experienced, one you've witnessed, or one you think you've experienced, I think can be a very viable treatment. But I don't think virtual reality is for every traumatized experience out there.
Dr. Roy, I'm just wondering if at Walter Reed you run across patients who from time to time fear situations that they themselves may not have been in, but some of their partners and their colleagues may have been exposed to.
Right. Well, a couple of comments. We do find that many individuals that we're treating have prior life traumatic experiences that in and of themselves did not necessarily lead to PTSD, but coupled with their experience in Iraq or Afghanistan, they did develop PTSD. In some cases, it's really the prior life trauma that seems to be more significant as we start to work through things with them. So we've, in those cases, backed off a little bit on how much time we spend in the virtual environment. But it still has been a cue that has triggered some of those feelings and memories and has facilitated us being able to work with them on some of that antecedent trauma as well as the combat-related trauma.
Here's Anna in Ellicott City, Maryland. Anna, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. My question is whether any of this type of therapy would be appropriate and available for persons who have been traumatized by child molestation, sexual abuse, and rape.
I can speak to this.
Please do, Josh.
This is Dr. Spitalnik. I can speak to this. In fact, I just responded to an email yesterday. We get a lot of inquiries from across the country when we do trade shows. We have a lot of partners across the country who ask this question. And it's a good question because the question is what treatments out there are there for those who have experienced any form of physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, more often sexual abuse in childhood, adolescence, or even as adults in domestic violent relationships? And the consensus amongst mental health professionals who are involved in VR work typically is is creating such an environment really crosses a lot of ethical and visual boundaries that I think most doctors are quite reticent to engage in. That being said, there are quite effective, really gold standard levels of treatment called CBT or exposure therapy or really prolonged exposure therapy that any trained clinical psychologist experienced in doing cognitive behavioral therapy can do. So creating a virtual environment, again, is a quite exciting and innovative opportunity, but I think there needs to be that balance between science and artism. And I think in this specific arena, people typically defer back to the traditional forms of cognitive behavioral or other talk therapies.
Anna, thank you very much for your call. We move on to Ed in Bethesda, Maryland. Ed, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. I wanted to get right to the point. I was stationed in the National Guard in Hawaii in 93 to 99, and there was a major there who had a reality treatment for PTSD on the big island of Hawaii between Mauna Kea and I was wondering if there was any if this is a evolutionary process, this reality, and also does this mean that the unit cohesion that we heard so much about at the beginning of the war is not working? Thank
you. Program, Ed, in the program you were talking about in Hawaii, veterans were actually taken into jungle-like settings on the island?
That's correct.
As opposed to a virtual reality setting. I don't know. You've covered anything at all like that, David?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if this addresses the caller's question, but there prior to virtual Iraq, there was a program that was partly engineered by Skip Rizzo that was virtual Vietnam that was used with Vietnam veterans. And it was a very effective program. It instead of putting people in the jungle, in the desert, it put them in a jungle in a kind of a hot landing site for a helicopter. The helicopter was coming down and it was being fired upon. And it worked very well for veterans who'd been suffering from PTSD for decades sometimes.
Michael Roy, how do you choose the patients who take part in these simulations? Is it appropriate for most soldiers who return to the U.S. with PTSD or trauma?
I believe so. We actually take volunteers from a variety of referral sources, from primary care, mental health. Some individuals have come forward just hearing about it, say, through David's article. Others have been referred by word of mouth from prior patients. Just following up on the caller's question, I do believe that unit cohesion, leadership, preparedness for duties, some of those factors that were identified in the aftermath of the first Gulf War are still important. And I think that generally we've done a pretty good job of improving those factors. And while Iraq in many ways is a perfect storm that has all the features to create PTSD, that the levels, the rates of PTSD that we've seen have probably been mitigated some by addressing some of these factors more effectively than we did necessarily in the Gulf War and prior conflicts.
Patrick Bordnick, it is my understanding that in your virtual environments, you actually use real actors to make the simulation as authentic as possible. Does it make a difference in a patient's response if that person is being offered a drink by a real person as opposed to a computer-generated avatar?
I think that's an interesting question, and that's one that I get often, is how real are these environments? And I think we all get asked that in virtual reality because we're trying to simulate the real world. The best thing is I can give you is what we've seen in the lab when we've seen people that are in the smoking environments actually reaching for virtual cigarettes. We have one particular scene in an alcohol study that we just finished where the bartender, and we programmed this in intentionally, when you walk up to the bar to order your drink of choice, the bartender actually goes down behind the bar and is acting like they're restocking and makes you wait for about 30 seconds. We actually have had people, and a real person pops up. Their video images that we film in green screen, so they're real people offering the drink, actually arguing with the bartender. We have nice party scenarios where people go into a party and there's about 10 or 20 people in there, and people would come out of there and we'd debrief with our patients, and they say, well, I felt, you know, kind of uncomfortable in the party. And, you know, you would ask, well, why would that be? Well, I'm a social person and I didn't get a chance to meet everybody at that party. So that tells me that we're engendering some real world emotional reactions in a virtual world that I think will be helpful therapeutically to help people overcome, you know, issues they have in these situations.
Josh Patelnik, we got this email from Don who says, please talk more about the potential usefulness of this technology for treating phobias. I'm writing as a 32-year-old woman who has never gotten a driving license out of an intense fear of driving. Can you talk me through the type of experience I might have?
Absolutely. And there are a lot of actual driving simulation programs across the country. That's probably one of the few phobias that we have yet to develop. You could probably Google or search out online for driving phobia and virtual reality treatments. There are a variety out there. But what one would experience would be not too much different than a game in terms of the visual experience. You'll be seeing yourself driving a car. You'll be controlling the driving experience. You'd see all the scenery and the environments, and you'd stop at traffic lights. What would make it clinical, what would make it something that would treat a phobia, is going back to the basics of treatment, which is a clinician sitting with you and spending the first two or three sessions getting all of the triggers, all of the situations, all of the sounds that really make this caller or this emailer afraid of driving. And you have to know that information first before you put someone into a virtual environment. And with that information, you can tailor the environment and the experience to the point where you do want to have them experience some fear. You do want them to be in a little bit of distress, because as long as they're not in distress, as evident of phobias, they're going to avoid facing the fear. And I think this is where the real art and skill of a trained clinician comes in, because otherwise it is just a game. You need to be able to induce some level of anxiety and distress in your patient enough to be able to have them habituate or deal with it long enough so it does go away on their own and they don't think they're going to die from it. But you need to make sure it's up at a level where they are experiencing a level of anxiety above and beyond their normal day-to-day operations.
Josh Patelnik is Director of Research and Clinical Services at Virtually Better, which is a Georgia-based company that creates virtual reality simulation programs. He's also Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Emory University School of Medicine. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. And I just want to let the audience know out there that if they have any questions or interest in virtual reality treatments with regard to research, the science, or clinics around the country, you can visit our website at virtuallybetter.com, navigate throughout it, and you'll see all the resources that are available throughout the country. Thank you very much for my time.
You'll find a link to that website at our website, kojoshow.org. Patrick Bordnick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. And again, if they want to learn more about substance abuse research in VR, I believe you have some video of the virtual worlds as well as the link to my website. So please feel free to email.
Dr. Bordnick is a professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work. Michael Roy, thank you for joining us. Dr. Roy is a colonel in the Medical Corps of the U.S. Army and director of the Division of Military Internal Medicine and professor of medicine in the Uniformed Services University of the Health Services. David Cohn, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Kojo.
David is a health and science reporter with the Baltimore Sun. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, Turning the Old Dominion Blue. Meet the man charged with bringing Virginia into Obama's camp, a big job in a state that hasn't supported a Democratic presidential candidate in more than 40 years. Plus, the search for the perfect cup of coffee, a look inside the world of roasting, distributing, and choosing the best beans. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up next.